It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This past weekend, a bike marshal at Civil Saturdays was arrested by plainclothes police and put into an unmarked van. Pittsburgh Police Commander Ed Trapp said at a press conference Sunday, authorities and protesters need to work together and coordinate march routes.
When there's sudden changes in how they're marching or they don't give us any information, we're basically speculating on what they're going to do, and that's no way to do this effectively and safely.
For 12 consecutive weeks, Black, Young, and Educated has organized the Civil Saturday protest, calling for police reform and legislation to end police brutality. Joining us is Nick Anglin, founder of the organization and CEO. Pittsburgh Public Safety said they just want protesters to share their march routes. If you, Black, Young, Educated, shared the route, do you think the police would act in good faith and let the protest move forward unimpeded?
It's in a complete contradiction of what we stand for, to be working with the same people that are oppressing us. You know, we're talking about increasing police accountability and amending Section 508, but yet working with police officers, that's a complete contradiction of what we stand for. So I don't see any time in the future where we'll be sharing route details with officers. It's common sense when you're at a protest, when we're taking a turn. Any person can tell. I know even sometimes on the mic, I even say we're taking a turn. Pittsburgh police are blatantly lying, saying we're spontaneous and we're taking one turn and then we switch and we take another.
Public Safety Director Wendell Hisrick said because of the lack of communication, the city is returning to guidelines it adopted in 2018, designating certain intersections as red or yellow to keep protesters from blocking critical intersections and streets. Will you avoid those intersections in your marches?
I know they are basically just saying that in order to silence the movement, to silence our voices. I make the routes myself. I make the routes for every Civil Saturday. I make sure that when I make a route, that the route doesn't block any hospitals or any, these excuses of we're blocking these important streets, that's a complete lie. The city of police are just saying that in order to stop these protests, in order to make these arrests for legitimately no reason.
No, Hisrick did not say that you were blocking these critical intersections at this time. But will you check out that list to make sure that you are not? Because you said you do the planning.
I'll make sure to check out those guidelines for upcoming Civil Saturday protests.
At your press conference Monday, you said police, civil service, or any public safety officers don't try to communicate with you. If they wanted to, how would your organization like that conversation to go?
Honestly, they just need to listen to what we have to say. The one interaction that I had with the Civil Affairs Unit, they were very condescending towards me. They didn't want to even have an open dialogue. It was basically like, I'm telling you this. They're going to want to speak with us. I'd want them to actually speak with us and have a conversation with us, not try to talk down to us and basically tell us what we have to do. So if anything's really unsafe in the matter, they can communicate that to the marshals, who are police liaisons and do speak with the police sometimes. You know, they could communicate that to the marshals. The marshals will surely get the message to me, and then we could come up with a decision to ensure everyone's safety.
Nick, has your message changed over the 12 weeks? Have your demands or your aspirations changed?
Our demands have stayed the same. Amend PA Section 508 to increase police accountability in Pennsylvania.
No, I have to interrupt there. That, of course, is that is a state law, nothing the city officials can do, correct?
Yeah, so that is a state law, nothing that the city officials can do, but we are raising awareness and we are definitely speaking with senators and representatives, and we are disrupting the streets in order to make sure our voices are heard by our state representatives.
Have you seen any progress? City Council in July unanimously passed a few pieces of legislation, police reform, and they were signed. Are you seeing any progress?
Those reformations were the bare minimum. There's so much more work that we need to do in order to make sure that our policing system is better in America. Yeah, banning weapons that should have already been banned really doesn't make a difference. We need to do so much more work and to ensure that if a police officer does something wrong, they are held accountable for their action just like a regular citizen would be.
Nick Anglin is the CEO, one of the founders of Black, Young, and Educated. Thanks so much, Nick, for your time.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today marks the centennial of the adoption of the 19th Amendment, when Tennessee became the 36th state to ratify the right for women to vote. Congress passed the amendment in June 1919, and Pennsylvania ratified it just 3 weeks later. WITF's Julia Agos takes a look at one Pennsylvanian's efforts for women's suffrage.
The women who drove the suffrage movement in the United States were born in the Victorian era, with corsets and manners and the expectation of motherhood. But with education and the Industrial Revolution, they ushered in a new era.
There was a gradual movement away from the idea of middle-class white women as being sort of fragile and limited to the role of mother and housewife during the Victorian era, while it was the men's role to be out in the wider world.
That's Professor Amy Ensley, director of the Hanke Center for the History of Women's Education at Wilson College. She says during this time, many people began to focus on building a well-educated society. As the need for teachers grew, women began filling those roles. Amy Farrell is a professor of women's history at Dickinson College. She says with their education, women began to step into roles previously reserved for men.
Activists were really tired of this concept of we're just going to wait and no more sort of playing the nice gal. So I think we see a huge shift there of women taking up more space in public areas and public arenas and saying we've had it.
Hannah Patterson embodied this new type of woman. Though she may not be a household name, Patterson was an integral member of the suffrage movement in Pennsylvania. Born in 1879, she was among the first women to graduate from college and pursue a career. At Wilson, in Franklin County, she learned how to research and speak in public with her experience on the debate team. And Ensley says the women at Wilson were also encouraged to be physically strong.
These women, because there was concern about maintaining their health, because again, you're coming from this sort of Victorian era of worrying about the fragility of women. Women were encouraged to be active and to be outside. And so Hannah Patterson played basketball and field hockey and tennis. And so she was sturdy and able to travel broadly in her work.
Patterson took the skills she learned at Wilson and channeled them into her career as an activist. She became the first chair of the Pennsylvania Women's Suffrage Party from 1912 to 1915, and she became the secretary of the National American Women's Suffrage Association in 1916. During this time, she advocated for women's rights and other progressive ideals like child labor and public health laws. At the Scranton Convention in November 1914, a Philadelphia newspaper, the Evening Ledger, described her as one of the most convincing speakers for the cause. Because there's no audio of Patterson's speech, WITF has recorded some of her words for this piece.
Man-made laws down the ages have been framed to protect property, including woman herself as a chattel. The modern woman wants them framed to protect life, to protect children in the schools and from factories, to raise the age of consent, to give us food free from adulteration. The great importance of this question lies in the fact that, deprived of the vote, women are cut off from the most important field of human activity.
In 1917, Patterson went on to join the war effort. The First World War sharply divided the suffrage movement. One of the most well-known suffragettes, Alice Paul, was against women giving up their momentum to join the war effort. Paul and her followers protested and picketed throughout the war. But Professor Farrell says Patterson and her group believed this was their opportunity to prove their worth to the political class.
Most suffragists said that the war effort is really important and that women's patriotism was a way to gain the respect of men and of the president.
Patterson became the resident director of the Women's Committee of the Council of National Defense in 1917, working directly under the Secretary of the Interior. Based in D.C., she directed the work with all 48 state divisions and coordinated the flow of information and requests for assistance between the federal agencies and the state divisions. Ensley says Patterson also recruited 25,000 nursing students and alerted states about the upcoming flu epidemic.
So Patterson's office acted as like a clearinghouse to match the requests for women war workers with the appropriate organization. So at that time, there were about 18,000 individual women's organizations, everything from the YWCA to different church groups and women's clubs. And so she would match up the requests with the different organizations.
In 1919, Patterson was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, an honor usually reserved for members of the military. The Secretary of the Interior wrote, "Patterson's effort contributed to the splendid coordination on the part of the women of the country in a great national emergency." After seeing the value of the women's contribution to the war, President Woodrow Wilson slowly came around to the idea of suffrage. He said in 1918, the war could not have been fought without the women's effort. He admitted the least he could do to repay them was allow them to vote. Congress officially adopted the 19th Amendment on August 26, 1920. It prohibits the states and federal government from denying the right to vote to citizens on the basis of sex. Patterson spent the latter part of her life in Pittsburgh, where she continued her work to elevate women in the political and professional world. She worked as the director of the women's department at J.H. Holmes Investment Securities from 1927 to 1932. There was also an unsuccessful movement to elect Patterson to Congress in 1936. She died a short time later. She never married nor had children. Now, 100 years after the 19th Amendment passed, Patterson's story and many like hers are relatively unknown. Farrell says part of the problem is the way U.S. history is taught.
We still learned that women were given the vote, and women were never given anything. Women fought really hard for the vote, and I think that's losing her story is part of that bigger picture.
Wilson College, along with many other universities, are trying to better preserve and promote the stories of women and minorities and their impact on U.S. history, ahead of what's expected to be a historic election in November. In Harrisburg, I'm Julia Agos.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Opening a business is a risky venture at any time that requires years of planning and work. But opening one during a pandemic, that's a whole new challenge. And one that Dave Kushner, the founder of Trace Brewing, took on. His taproom and brewery plans to open in September in Bloomfield. He spoke with The Confluence's Mary Lee Williams.
First off, can you tell us how the opening is going?
So as you would expect, we are delayed from our original timeline, definitely encountering some overrun costs, some fixed costs that we were not planning on incurring, such as rent. We're shooting to open here in about 30 days, hopefully in the beginning of September. Originally, we were shooting for mid-March, right around when the shutdown began.
How much has your vision of opening Trace changed from last year to now?
So the long-term vision has remained the same. Our goal is to be a community-centric neighborhood brewery and taproom. And so the architectural decisions, the design decisions remain the same. And really building it to be a comfortable space for people to sit in, to get to know each other, to drink beer. In the short term, and I would say short term is until there is a vaccine, we've made some adjustments, whether it is, you know, adjusting what our operational hours and days are going to be, the number and type of staff we're going to be hiring, the number of fixtures such as tables we're going to be purchasing day one, since our capacity is going to be greatly reduced. Mostly the adjustments have been understanding how we fit into the larger picture of what is the community looking for until there's a vaccine, and getting our product out there in distribution, which was not part of the initial plan.
This might sound like a weird question, but like, how are you doing? That sounds really stressful.
You know, when it comes to the brewery, when it comes to the business, of course, this is a very stressful time. I mean, being delayed 5 months creates a lot of stress and unknowns, and opening up into a market with lots of unknowns. And so you shift all your expectations, all your short-term plans, and the goal now is to survive and to survive until there's a vaccine, whether that's summer 2021, whether that's fall 2021. You adjust to get to that point in time, which was something that, of course, when you're going through the business plan, when you're speaking to community members, when you're speaking to investors and banks, that's never part of the plan. You plan for a rainy day. You don't plan for a hurricane, which is what we're going through. And so like you do in a hurricane, I'm from South Florida, the goal is to survive and see the other side of it. And that's kind of where we're at mentally as a business, which is to just survive, to make enough money to get by, and knowing that there will be a light at the end of the tunnel, and we think our business will succeed on the other end of it. I think even more so, the pandemic has shown us that local and community-focused places are really, really vital because, you know, there's going to be a lack of tourism. There's going to be a lack of people coming to certain cities and certain areas. I think that there will be a desire for the local community in the neighborhood to go out and support those businesses and to see each other again when this is all over.
Right now, occupancy is currently at 25%. That's the governor's requirements for bars and restaurants. But that could change. As a new business that's just opening, how do you plan to navigate the restrictions that are changing often?
You try to stay as nimble and as slim as possible. You try to buy the least amount of brewing materials you need, so that way there's no waste. You hire the minimal amount of staff, so that way should restrictions get more restrictive, there isn't a large amount of overhead. And you plan your projections for low, medium, and high scenarios. And the worst case scenario is being completely shut down again, which we are planning for. And I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that's part of our projections, is being closed for 30, 60, 90 days completely and only selling beer to go and only selling beer to distributors. Then you plan for the medium, which is this 25%. And you show projections for that, and you make sure you have the staff you need, you make sure you have the materials you need to brew beer, and that the numbers still work. And then I think the best we're going to get until there's a vaccine is probably 50% capacity back to where we were several weeks ago. And so even the high, the best case scenario in your projections until there's a vaccine isn't great, but you want to make sure that the business can survive in the low, medium, and high projections.
Dave Kushner, the founder of Trace Brewing, which is to open next month in Bloomfield. He spoke with The Confluence's Mary Lee Williams. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.